The NCAA basketball tournament, or March Madness, has become a huge business. According to Forbes, CBS and Turner Broadcasting make more than $1 billion off the games, thanks in part to a $700,000 ad rate for a 30-second spot during the Final Four. In 2014, ESPN signed a 12-year deal worth $7.3 billion for broadcasting rights to the college football playoff. Each of the four semifinal teams earned their conference a $6 million payout from the college football playoff. Athletic conferences receive millions and millions of dollars in payouts from the NCAA when their teams advance deep into the tournament. Ditto for the coaches of the final squad standing. The NCAA as a whole makes over $6 billion annually. In 40 states, the highest paid public employee is the state university's head football or basketball coach. There are 1,083 colleges and universities competing in sports that fall under the NCAA's governance. They are grouped into three divisions, which are defined by athletic scholarship rules and the amount of money that schools spend on sports. For example, Division I schools, which are typically large, can offer many full athletic scholarships. Division II schools can offer partial athletic scholarships, and Division III schools are not allowed to offer sports scholarships. There are 346 Division I schools, and of them, 123 are classified as members of the Football Bowl subdivision, the top tier of sports competition. A total of 20 athletic programs in the FBS reported a positive net revenue for the 2013 fiscal year. The median or average loss among athletic departments in this grouping was $11.6 million. According to the report, all athletic departments outside of the FBS lose money. They operate in the red. Meanwhile, many pundits have a serious bone to pick with the obscene amount of millions paid to college coaches, while many of their athletes from impoverished backgrounds are struggling to get by under strict NCAA rules regarding limiting any exchange of money or services. All television revenue, ticket and jersey sales, likeness promotions, and other sources of income go to the NCAA, the schools, the coaches, the event staffs, and everyone else involved in the business, except for the athletes creating the value. Last year, the NCAA men's basketball tournament generated $1.15 billion in television ads, well beyond the revenue generated by the NFL and NBA playoffs. And yet some would argue that these athletes are offered far more than just a monetary stipend in terms of scholarships, playing opportunities, and a greater education. It's a tricky debate to say the least, especially if you consider paying athletes, starting first with where the money would come from. The NCAA, the schools, the institutions themselves, and once Title IX and fair treatment for women's athletics comes into play, it's even trickier. Whether or not college athletes should be paid is a debate worth having. In fact, it's a debate we're going to have here on the Baker's Dozen podcast. My name is River City Clement, the host of the Baker's Dozen podcast, and you're listening to our fourth season's premiere episode. It's hard to believe, but over the past 2 years, we've now totaled over 80 episodes through 3+ seasons. And after nearly a year in the making, it's finally time for the episode I've been looking forward to so much more than any other to happen. It's our first ever roundtable debate. The topic, whether or not college athletes should be paid. So let's have at it, roundtable style, right now. Season 4 of the Baker's Dozen podcast, hosted by yours truly, River City Clement. It officially kicks off now. I could not be more excited for you guys to be here and to get our first ever roundtable debate started. It's a topic we've talked about around the campfire. It's a topic that we've talked about around the bar. It's something that we need to discuss, and it's something that hopefully we can change a few opinions of the listeners. So let me start by introducing each debater, giving them a minute or so to outline what they're going to say for this debate with their opening statement. First up to introduce himself, Jimmy Wright.
What's going on, everybody? The Mac is back, you know it. I'm here to do this roundtable debate. Super excited about it. Right now, I'm just going to lay down my opening statement. I'm in favor of these college athletes getting paid, and here's exactly why. In any part of college life, only one class of people have any financial restriction on them at all, and that's the college athlete. No other student is told what they can and cannot make, and if it affects their education, scholarship, or anything. For example, if you're a music student who's on a full music scholarship, you can apply your trade in any professional sense you want. You're not kicked out of the band. You're not kept from performing on campus. It doesn't affect your academic status in any way. You're celebrated for that, not the athletes. And that doesn't seem right to me at all.
Next up on the opposite side of the spectrum, Trey Fernandez.
Clement, thanks for having me, man. We've had this argument a million times. I can't wait to have it again. The simple fact is there's no equal fair way to pay college athletes. I think this would destroy college sports. The people that think otherwise are not worried about college players at all. They're only worried about people making lots of money. In other words, this has nothing to do with college players and everything to do with the money.
And our third voice, one that you've heard before, maybe the one that they're trying to sway, we'll see, is Brett Needham.
Clement, thanks for having me. You're a great host as always. I'm excited to be here as the independent, the Ross Perot of this debate, if you will. So, should college athletes be paid? I'm of the opinion that many college athletes are already being paid. I do consider a scholarship as a form of payment. And it would be naive to think that there aren't many college athletes already being paid under the table, which has been going on for decades. I do think that if we are to open Pandora's box of making direct payments to these athletes and take on all the problems that are going to come with it, these payments should be related to endorsements from the private sector, large or small. These payments should absolutely not be coming from the universities themselves.
For the second part of this debate, the meat and potatoes section, I'm going to pose four questions to each debater in a round-robin format. If another person wants to interject, well, they'll allow that person to stop speaking, and then they'll have their rebuttal ready, and we'll just let it go. The first question is for Jimmy. Jimmy, in 1973, the NCAA restricted scholarships to 1 year at a time, meaning that a coach could revoke a player's scholarship if he or she wasn't performing well on the field, regardless of how well they performed in the classroom. Jimmy, do you feel that most people understand the limitations of scholarships for student athletes and the lack of continuous admittance into the university that they offer?
No, I do not. I don't think they understand that at all. I don't think the casual sports fan understands what the ins and the outs of the scholarships is, and that they can be stripped from any athlete with basically no reasoning whatsoever. But with that, you know, I have a solution for that. Contracts, man, they're used in the professional world, business. They're used in the professional world of sports. Let's bring to the college level. That's something each side that could negotiate. It wouldn't be that hard. Players sign contracts. They'd be bound by those contracts. They performed per the contracts and the terms on that contract, as would the school. All the school needs to say is that it's an open system. You can pay what you like. The other rules, you've got 4 years of eligibility. You can play those 4 and 5. You have to remain in good standing as a full-time student in your institution. You have to qualify academically the same way in order to be able to play. And if I'm recruiting you, say, VCU, hometown, let's do this, Rams. We want Clement to play for us. I'm going to come to Clement and say, we think you can be great for us. We'll offer you a 3-year contract, $100,000 a year, plus room and board and books. A condition of this contract is you will have to remain in good academic standing at all times. If you fall out of academic standing, we have a right to terminate that contract. If you get arrested, charged for a crime or a misdemeanor, we can terminate that contract. If you decide to leave, you're not going to go play for anywhere else. You can't play in the pros. You can't play in college. You can't go and compete against us because we, VCU, I'm that AD at VCU, we invested in you. We can't force you to play here. We're going to keep you from playing somewhere else. Clement's side could rebuttal if they'd like. They say, Clement comes back and says, I'm good enough to leave in 2 years, so I'll take a 2-year contract. It could be for less money, but I want the opportunity to leave or renegotiate after 2 years. Contingencies could also be negotiated upon, such as the academic and behavioral side. For instance, Clement, he's a pretty straight-laced guy in general. I don't think he'd have this problem at all, but say he's not going to have his contract relying upon some false arrest if he's not convicted of that crime. He would agree to that. But if he's just arrested on something, then no. You would negotiate it out the way anyone else would. It's easy. It's not that hard. The rest of the world is able to operate in the free market. College athletics, the players, they can't. What's that about?
So if you're not allowed to leave whenever you want, that takes all possibilities of a transfer off the table. So therefore, you're telling me quarterbacks like Joe Flacco, Cam Newton, and Russell Wilson might not be in the NFL today.
Why would they not be in the NFL today then? Their performance got them in the NFL, not the fact that they transferred.
But they're all transfers. They had the opportunity to show their skills at a different school than they started at.
Yeah, you just have to sit out for the year. You can transfer after that is up. It's like a 3-year contract. We have the right to you for 3 years. If you leave after that second year, yeah, you're definitely not going to go anywhere to play in that 1 year because you signed that contract with us. After that contract is up, transfer whatever you want. We don't care where you go after that. But under the terms of that contract, absolutely not. You're not transferring anywhere else. No, we made the investment in you. You turned your back on us. Why would we let you go play somewhere else?
Can a player be traded?
I haven't looked into that, but I would see no problem with that as long as that institution that you're getting them traded to is able to pick up their contract and fulfill the agreement that we have with that kid.
So basically, if you sign a letter of intent to play for a school, regardless of whether it's close to your family, you want to play for a certain coach, you want a degree from there, if you get traded, that's just kind of tough shit.
Well, like in all other contracts, any other sport, you could definitely put some clauses in there. No trade clause. I don't want to go here. I don't want to move too far away from my parents. I don't want to move to this region. I don't want to play for this guy. It can all be negotiated on. That's why it's a contract.
What's to stop the top players from negotiating one-year contracts and making this sort of like a mercenary type situation in which you spend a year at Florida State, you spend a year at Auburn, you spend a year at Washington? Would there be a minimum requirement that you would have for a contract?
No, I don't see having to have a one-year minimum or a minimum place on any of those contracts. I just don't see the advantage for somebody wanting to jump around from school to school, conference to conference like that. I don't understand why they would do it. Maybe I'm missing something, but I mean, if you're down to play for an institution, you like what they got going on, they send you over a good offer that's going to take care of you while you're in school. You're going to be able to showcase your talents. Why would you want to leave there?
First question for Fern. Advocates of paying college athletes often struggle to explain, first, how the labor market for players would function. Second, how the Division I colleges could afford this expense when the median D1 athletics program loses $11 million a year. Everyone's not Alabama. So the question becomes, how is this new system going to impact college culture? And what would happen to the branding of intercollegiate athletics that tens of millions of fans have come to love? So Trey, as a fan of college football, do you feel the game would lose some of its integrity if athletes are paid?
I honestly don't think the game would lose anything if athletes were paid. It would be exactly the same. I don't think the players are going to play any harder. I don't think they're going to try to win more. I don't think the product is any different from what it is right now.
Brett, the NCAA argues that college athletes are paid with a free education. The reality is that players' opportunities are not free, and half of the revenue-producing athletes don't graduate. College athletes spend 40 hours per week of labor in their sport alone, according to a recent NCAA study, generate billions of dollars per year, and can lose their scholarship if they're injured. Brett, do we discount too readily the free education that is offered to student athletes? Isn't their true purpose while attending a university to be a student first?
Well, I would imagine that some discount it, but when you consider that this year only 2% of high school athletes will receive a scholarship, you could say being awarded a full ride scholarship to college is like hitting the lottery. Not only is this an opportunity to get a world-class education for free, it's an experience like no other that can be beneficial for a lifetime. To your second question, you know, it doesn't really matter what I think their true purpose for attending college is. The reality is their purpose is to perform at a high level and bring victory and recognition to their schools through their athletic endeavors. You know, we're being told by the NCAA that education comes first, and that's just the biggest crock of shit I've ever heard. The NCAA wants to bring in money first and foremost. They're a business. Make no mistake about it.
If the NCAA is a business and they are hiring these athletes without paying them, the NCAA can't have any revenue without this talent. Why do these players not get rewarded for helping the NCAA to do exactly what you said, make money?
It's because the players have no leverage. Fans are going to be loyal to their teams no matter what. You know, maybe if these players can get organized and stage a walkout or something like that, maybe they can make some noise and get some leverage. But to me, they're interns. You know, they're there for experience and for exposure. And where's the money coming from? I mean, that's the big question here. Where is this money going to be coming from?
I think the first place that a lot of people look at is the $6 billion that's in revenue for the NCAA, the money that's made off of March Madness TV deals. Now, obviously, it's a little tough as many schools do not turn a profit. But shouldn't the NCAA as a whole, and not the universities themselves, many of which operate in the red, be the one that's paying this money? How is it that $6 billion that's earned by these student athletes representing these universities, how come they can't be rewarded for delivering the product?
They are rewarded. They're rewarded in my first statement about their scholarships and experiences and opportunities. It's easy to get googly-eyed when you see all this money coming in, but like you said, these programs are operating in the red.
I think the facilities also make the athletes better. If you're enhancing the facilities for the players, it makes the players better as a whole.
So being able to play Madden football on an 80-inch plasma is going to make you a better student athlete?
No, but a world-class weight room and great coaching staffs do.
Jimmy, your second question. A joint study between the National College Players Association and Drexel University shows that the NCAA will strip football and men's basketball players of $6 billion of their fair market value between 2011 and 2015. In contrast, the NCAA admits that its scholarship limit leaves full scholarship athletes with $3,000 to $5,000 in out-of-pocket expenses each year. Jimmy, student athletes are often seen as being given a full ride, but they share similar debts with no way to pay them while attending school. How does this affect the argument to pay athletes or not?
All right, the way I look at it is this, man. child actors get, so if all these big studios get together and they collude up and they say, look, we're not going to pay these kids anymore, but what we're going to do, we're going to give them their expenses, we're going to give them really, really super nice accommodations on set, we'll even give them tutors, acting coaches, and anything like that to make it a really good experience for them. But we can all agree that we're not going to pay them anymore. Any debts they incur outside of that movie that they have to deal with on their own, let them take care of it on their own. So like, for example, say your kid is Macaulay Culkin and they say, look, we're just going to pay for the expenses. And if he does a really good job, maybe when you're older and then you become adult, yeah, you can get paid then, man. No, that's not how it works. Billions of dollars are being made. That kid's the star of the show. He's not getting a piece of that. No, doesn't add up, man. It's not right.
We're talking about an industry in which Macaulay Culkin has signed a contract. Maybe his parents had to sign it as well. He has an agent fighting for representation. I find myself struggling, and I'm hoping that one of you three can answer this. As a full-time athlete, you cannot have a part-time job. You can't have a paying internship. If you want to go out with your friends and you want to get something to eat, if you want to buy yourself a suit because you're going to a wedding, if you want to be able to buy a birthday gift for a significant other, you have no extra source of income. And Needham, you brought up a fantastic point. A lot of players are getting hush money, and that doesn't make it okay. But I wonder if it also makes it okay to justify not paying them. So here's my question to somebody. What are you going to tell those athletes that have no ability, especially from low income, to be able to get a job like many other college students and pay for those outside purchases that they'd like to have?
I would tell them to quit and go get a job if that's what they want.
It's a hard argument to go against. You're choosing to sacrifice those things. You know, my contract argument kind of blows up in my face when you sign a scholarship. You are, in fact, signing a contract. We're going to jump back to Trey. Many fans also like to imagine that college sports are somehow simpler and less corrupt than professional sports. But nothing could be further from the truth. College athletics are just as much of a big business as professional sports. It's just the money goes into the pockets of coaches, athletic directors, conference commissioners, and sports media executives. Trey, do you believe the system would be more or less corrupt than it is right now by paying athletes?
This is a tough question because it depends on how the players are paid. Paying players large amounts of money will eliminate 99% of selling your jerseys, your championship rings, taking money from boosters because they already have the money. Paying athletes small amounts of money will do nothing. Players that feel cheated are going to feel entitled, and they'll want to get money some way or another.
Which transitions us back to Brett. Brett, would you be open to eliminating restrictions on student athletes' abilities to seek commercial opportunities by permitting endorsement deals or being compensated when entities use their rights of publicity? So, for example, jerseys are sold or promos are used on television to sell a game, or perhaps they can work for local businesses. The money could be held in a trust fund until graduation or divvied out right away, and provide a legal right to any future earnings from profits a school receives from using their image.
Yes, and I absolutely love this idea. I'm a businessman. I know you've got to make hay while the sun shines. There will never be an argument that will make me say, you're right, Nike shouldn't be allowed to give Reggie Bush a $10 million contract. This is America, and if Clement's Burrito Shack wants to have a local college athlete in his commercial and kick the kid a few hundred bucks, what's the problem with that? The powers that be in the NCAA desperately do not want this to happen because obvious issues will arise, but that shouldn't matter. You know, if these coaches and ADs are going to make millions of dollars, then they can prove their worth and deal with these issues. You know, I think the trust fund idea would help curb some of the problems, you know, that would come with giving a kid a bunch of money while still expecting him to stay focused. But I say, if you make a deal with Nike and they cut you a check, that's your money and you should be able to do whatever you want to with it. It's time to trust these young men and women, treat them like adults, teach them when they make a mistake, not try to control them like they're an animal in the Bronx Zoo.
Shout out to the Bronx Zoo, fourth grade field trip. Jimmy, what would you say to the argument that certain institutions having the ability to offer a larger amount of compensation than others, and that there is a real potential of seeing the recruiting process turn into a de facto free agency where the rich schools get richer? Are we just going to end up in a situation in which the same five or six schools can afford to pay those players much more than the smaller ones?
Well, I mean, those big schools that everyone talks about right now, they're so powerful as it is. I mean, they couldn't get any more powerful. I mean, but a market right now that is a restrictive market on labor when everybody is allowed to pay the same thing, Kentucky, Duke, UCLA, those big schools, Alabama, they already have an incredible advantage because of the resources that they already possess. So the better players are going to those schools where the nice facilities, the exposure, and everything like that is. But say you're Wichita State. They're not getting the players that Kansas are recruiting. They can't afford to attract the top players that Kansas are recruiting, but they could pool those resources they have as a school, pay more for Kansas's third best player than Kansas could. So they would be able to 4 more talent that way, and then they could go make such decisions as, you know what, maybe down the line we don't need these gigantic facilities. We can throw more money into the procurement of talent. Get better guys to come to the school when they have money to offer to give them that stuff. Just because they don't have those facilities that Kansas and all them have, but they can spend the money that they're allowed to have and throw it at a player if they want them to come there. Kansas be able to spend more money? Absolutely. They have more money. But the big schools are already getting 95% of the top 100 players right now anyway. Maybe more than that. We're not going to see any difference in that, but we are going to see a difference if the smaller schools would be allowed to compete.
What would focusing all your money on one sport do to all the other remaining sports at the college?
They're not going to focus on just one sport. They're going to focus on getting better players for each sport as it is. They have that money. They have those resources to hand out, to dole out if they want somebody. Like, I mean, say there's one of the best rowers in the nation. They want that guy. They're going to go out there and get him because they have the money and they have the resources to throw at him. It doesn't matter. I mean, like I said, you can take away from a fund. They don't need these big, elaborate weight rooms and all that other stuff to get good players there when you're able to throw money at them.
We'll go back to Trey. When an athlete signs on the national letter of intent, they know what they're signing up for. If they have a problem with it, they don't have to sign it. Trey, isn't this proof that athletes know what they're signing up for and shouldn't be paid? Do you feel as if too many people call these athletes victims unnecessarily?
Yes, you sign a letter of intent, and this clearly states that the college is not paying you any money. Regardless of how much the coaches get paid, regardless of how much the school makes on ticket sales, regardless of the merchandise, and regardless of how much the NCAA brings in. Does this make college athletes victims? No. The athlete gets all the perks of his or her scholarship, and they get to play the sport they love at a high level. You could ask any Division III or walk-on player this, and they would take that, I'm sure.
This is a really popular argument that I've heard from you, Fern. The fact that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these players maybe don't realize how lucky they are to play for these schools at this high of a level. Here's my question to you. Is the NCAA pulling in the rankings and the ratings that they do with lesser talent? You know, the argument I often hear is, well, if this guy from Northern Iowa could play at Alabama, he would do it for free. But doesn't that hurt college football when that refuses to recognize their elite talent? If you think about a business, if Capital One is hiring, there's plenty of people coming out of college that would be ecstatic to have that job. But Capital One is going to go after the best and the brightest, the people that work the top internships, the people that have the top skills for those positions. So much like Capital One would suffer from hiring lesser qualified employees, wouldn't college football as a whole suffer if we continue to neglect top athletes and their ability to make a lot of money for the NCAA?
Product would be the same to me by paying them, though. We're not adding that much more. It's the same product on the field. If you're just giving them money. So by saying that, it's basically just saying, let's pay them and watch the same thing we're watching right now. So I can't agree with that just because we're seeing college football. College football is already great. By paying them, it's not going to make it any better.
Brett, last year, the National College Players Association released a report called The Price of Poverty in Big Time College Sports. Their report concluded that 86% of college athletes live below the poverty line. The fact that Texas football players are valued each at $513,000+, or that Duke basketball players each are worth over $1.2 million, and they may be living below the poverty line. Brett, is not any of this revenue owed to these college athletes, considering so many of them are living in what we would consider to be poverty?
The short answer is an emphatic no. Look, these numbers are compelling, but the only thing collegiate athletes are owed is what is promised to them at the time they agree to attend their school. I personally find this sense of entitlement to be kind of rather concerning. I mean, a man tells you what you're going to get, you shake his hand, and you are entitled to what was promised, no more, no less. If the collegiate athletes can organize, increase their leverage, which I've stated is almost none, and they can make arrangements to share in these profits, then and only then would they be owed any of that revenue. Doesn't matter how poor the athletes are, it doesn't matter how much money the university makes. The only thing that is owed is what is promised. End of story. I don't make the rules. This is just how business works. I'd like it to be a perfect world. In a perfect world, everyone would go to college. No one would get hurt playing football, but we know that's not how the world works.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like we are looking at, we've always done it this way. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just because this is how the system is, why is there not a greater movement to fix it? Why are we not pushing to make the system better? I love your unionization talk, and I think that's the first step that players have to take, despite the failures, or at least the lack of success Northwestern University had with several members of its football team trying to unionize. Because the only way to have progress is to challenge the system and try to find a better way of looking at things. I think Fern's going to jump in for a second.
I'm real open to that, the idea of paying players. players, I just don't think it can be done. There's just no fair, equal way to pay everybody across the board. It just can't be done. I mean, if we figured out some kind of way with a reasonable amount of money and could pay every single college athlete around the same figure, I think it could be done. But I just don't see that happening.
And I mean, I am for paying players, but through endorsements and through the private sector. I think the money that's coming into the university should be spent back into the university on facilities.
So when you talk endorsements, are we limiting the playing field that can earn them? Reggie Bush can earn those endorsements, but can the USC offensive line, who helped Reggie Bush to so much of his success, earn it? Or are they left out because they don't have the name and recognition of Reggie Bush?
Well, they're more than likely going to be left out. I mean, but that doesn't mean they can't get a smaller endorsement somewhere else locally or something like that. I mean, that's up to them. You know, personality would go a long way in securing some endorsements as well, but the best are going to get paid the most. I mean, it's just the way the world.
And I actually agree with you completely. That is a way of the world that's never going to change. People with charisma, people with talent are always going to find themselves in greater positions. We're going to go to everybody's final question. Jimmy, one of the arguments that we keep hearing from two people that are opposing you at this point is scholarships, and that the scholarship is plenty of a reward. It's plenty of a benefit. It's something that you sign up for. What's your overall view on scholarships and some of the misconceptions that surround them?
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely one of the talking points whenever this gets brought up by a lot of people. It's just, you know, they get offered that scholarship and it paying for itself and to get their education and this and that. It's really nice. It is. But we're talking about this is from a business standpoint, really, and about the NCAA making money and these kids not getting any piece of it, which, again, like I'll say, it's just not right. Tell everybody out there just to think about what the scholarship is. The scholarship is a dollar amount that is transferred from the athletic department to the school. That school is basically just paying itself. It's like if my parents, if they start paying themselves rent for having me move back into their house, then my parents claim they don't have any money left because they pay themselves rent for me. The NCAA makes billions of dollars, and these athletes they're told all the time, you get your expenses. That's all you get. You only get your expenses. And one of the biggest components of the expenses you get, they pay to themselves and claim it costs them money. It doesn't seem right. People explain and claim that scholarship is enough. Well, if the scholarship is enough, man, I say we test it out. Let's test it out in that marketplace. If it's enough, then the marketplace will confirm that. They know it's not true. They know these players are worth a ton, and these schools would compete for them the same way they compete for any athlete of university life.
Trey, the success of the program, while that student is there, is not guaranteed. But if Texas A&M stands to make an estimated $72 million alone off branded merchandise in 1 year, as reported in Time Magazine during the Johnny Manziel years, connected to his success, what would you say to Johnny Manziel, who felt that he was used by the University of Texas A&M, never receiving from the university 1 cent in return for all he brought to them?
The Cleveland Browns would have a field day with this question right here. Texas A&M has had a football program since 1894. They have 700 wins and 3 national championships without Johnny Football. Texas A&M gave Manziel a place to play and show off his talents. He was later drafted in the first round and made plenty of money. I like to compare him to Tim Tebow. They were both great college players and NFL busts. The difference is Tim Tebow thanks God, his coaches, his teammates, and the University of Florida for everything he has. Manziel appreciates nothing and has squandered every opportunity that's been given to him.
Brett, the last question for this section of the roundtable debate. Some believe that all athletes should be allowed to earn money from commercial endorsements, which could be put into a trust fund. Brett, do you believe that college athletes should be able to profit off of their own like, but is there a limit to how much they can profit, and are there restrictions to who they can profit from?
I don't think there should be any restrictions. I don't think there should be a limit on how much they could profit or who they can profit from. If a college athlete is being used in this manner and is wearing school colors or logos, then a percentage of the profits would be negotiated between the player and the school. If a company wants to pay you to use your likeness, there isn't one good reason in the world why they shouldn't be able to.
Brett, you've had a lot of follow-ups from me, and that's what's tough about being an independent. You get it from both sides, but you've handled it perfectly. Does it bother you if a liquor company, if a tobacco company, somebody from a less than reputable organization, at least according to NCAA standards, wants to have, you know, them endorsed by that player? Or do you feel that there should be a list that the NCAA puts out? Or is it a free-for-all? Should the player be able to sell that as long as they're of age to use it themselves?
There's no way the NCAA would ever go for this without producing a list of approved, you know, vendors that they can, you know, take endorsements from. A part of me wants to say let it be a free-for-all, but I just know that wouldn't be reality at all.
I think at the end of the day, too, you're still representing your school. So the school would also have to approve of what you're, you know, advertising with their name as well on products as your name.
Which is why everybody should be endorsed by Clement's Burrito Shack. I think we all can agree on that. And for our final segment, some quick hit questions with follow-ups by me to each debater. The question is not given in advance, and I'm going to follow up. Jimmy, one of the things that you talked about was contracts, and that scares the hell out of me. What on earth are we going to do with the fact that hundreds and hundreds of athletes at each school are going to need to negotiate contracts as 17-year-olds? How is this going to be paid for? How is this going to be done fairly? And how do we not end up with thousands of D1 athletes already in debt for lawyer fees the first day they start at their school?
That's a really good question, man. There's no really other way to put it except for these kids are almost going to be betting on themselves. People aren't going to like to hear it, but you know, when you brought in the negotiation point of it, there's going to have to be you know, agents and stuff involved like that, and kind of like how they're involved right now. They enter agreements with these these agents, you know, based off contingency plans that they are going to get to the draft and they are going to get drafted. I think it's just one of those necessary evils that has to get done in order for these kids to come out with a fair shake here.
While there's never a guarantee that an athlete is going to be drafted where they believe they are, that they're going to reach the contract level that they think they are, typically when you hire an agent to join the draft, you're expecting a contract. There is little to no guarantee, even for the top athletes, that they might face injury. There's little to no guarantee that 3 or 4 years from then, after their contract is over, that they're going to be a desirable entity to the NFL draft or the NBA draft or the Major League draft. So my question to you is, how on earth can you guarantee these kids are going to be able to pay this back? Or are you just adding to their debt ceiling by saying, you know, I hope in 3 years you're going to be drafted. You need to bet on yourself, barring injury, academic struggles, or perhaps being dropped on the depth chart.
Well, hopefully these kids, while they're in school, well, they do go through and they get that contract. They're in school. They're doing the right thing. They're doing what they're supposed to do. And that's, this contract acts as, a lot of people will like to bring it up, it's essentially going to be a scholarship. Like I said earlier, there'll be contingency plans and verbiage in that contract where they have to hold up their end of the bargain as far as academics go while they're in that school. These are some of the top academic schools in the nation that these kids go out there and play really good sports for. So hopefully they're in there doing what they're supposed to do. And they're going to school. And if, you know, God forbid something happens to this kid, he can't play football anymore. He holds up his end of the bargain as far as academics go. He's going to get a really good education out of it, and he's going to get a great job that he can provide for himself and his family down the road when he gets out of there.
Yeah, I just want to add to your point, Clement, or your question about, you know, how are these players going to afford these lawyers? It's another good example of why these players should unionize. If they do that, everybody pays in a little bit of union dues. That Players Association hires lawyers to represent these players going forward with their, you know, with their contracts with the universities.
And for the record, I would have signed a contract at 18 for 2 kegs of beer.
It's absolutely fantastic. There's nothing I could say about that. Smiley Kaufman would be proud. All right, Trey, your final question. According to a 2011 survey conducted by the NCAA, the average student athlete spends 43 hours a week at their sport and 38 hours on academics. That is an 81-hour work week, which is far more challenging than most full-time jobs. Look, it's well established that they cannot also have outside jobs or internships once you enter into an athletic agreement. Trey, student athletes aren't afforded the same class schedule that full-time students can get. How do you justify an 80-hour work week in a $6 billion industry and no chance to earn any revenue off of yourself?
I love that we're comparing playing sports to a work week. I personally still play sports, and I pay people money so that I can play sports. I work a 45, 46-hour work week every single week. I try to play as many sports as I can, and I love it. I wouldn't trade it for the world. So the fact that these guys have to play sports and we consider it work, I mean, high school kids do the same thing all the time. Might not be the same amount of numbers, but high school kids still put in the amount of work that some college teams do.
I just real quick wanted to shout out Crucial Taunt. We're coming for that spring championship next year for sure.
We're going to do it in the fall too. You know what? That is a fantastic point, and I am never going to shortchange how hard you work, the amount of hours that you work, and that you're underpaid for doing it. But when you play football and you do pay to do it and you love it and you work hard at it and you train for it, you prep for it, there are not 100,000 people in the stands watching Crucial Taunt games. I wish there were. There should be. There are not ESPN River City Sports, you know, segments that are being going on with huge ad rates. College football games, the average attendance is going to be above 50,000 if you're looking at a major Division I school. You're thinking about all the revenue that's being made off of jerseys. I wish somebody made a Trey Fernandez jersey. I'd wear it. But Dalvin Cook, he can't make money off of jerseys with his number. Johnny Manziel can't make money off of t-shirts or hats with his number or his likeness on there. What's the justification for these athletes that have this type of revenue being produced? How do you justify all this money because of what they're doing and they still don't see a dime?
This is the same argument we've been having the whole time. It's more about the money than the players. Everybody's mad that all this money's coming in. We still have to remember, too, there is a name on the front of the jersey as well, the school. It's not always about the player. Some people buy jerseys because they actually like the team. Also, this goes back to the high school argument. High school players wear uniforms. They wear apparel. They sell high school apparel. Coaches get paid. Tickets get sold at a much lower level, but does that not mean that they're not entitled to some kind of money? It's the exact same thing, just on a much lower scale.
And our final question goes to Brett. Now, this is not an economics-based podcast, so I'm going to throw something out there. $6 billion industry, the NCAA. How is it, Brett, that we can't justify spending between $50 and $150 million out of that to find even a low-level stipend for players? Money can be allocated, but you mean to tell me that less than 5% of that income can't be spent on paying the players for what they feel they've earned?
Yeah, it's a good question. To be honest, I would just personally prefer that money go to financial aid, more scientists, more teachers, more better facilities, more labs, more research, things to make society a better place. As I've stated, I personally feel like these guys are already getting paid, most of them. Free education, world-class university. I mean, that's just a dream come true. It would be for, you know, 99% of the population of the world.
My final thought is that I sometimes wonder if I am simultaneously shortchanging the incredible education that these students are being offered, especially since many of these athletes would never be afforded this education based on their academic standing in high school. Devil's advocate for me says that these players, they are in a high demand industry, and they are the only high demand industry that I can think of above 18 that do not have a chance to earn part of the revenue that they've helped earn. I want to thank all three of these gentlemen for coming on this debate. This is not easy. I'm throwing out questions that they have had no chance to prepare for. They've only had a little bit of time to do this. They've done it out of basically just their interest in the topic, helping me out. So gentlemen, collectively, I cannot thank you enough. This is by far my favorite episode of this podcast thus far, and I cannot wait to listen to it again. And I hope that everybody listening takes in all three perspectives, because one of the things that I think that we're struggling with in our current political landscape is that nobody is willing to meet in the middle ground. And I think that a topic like this, just as elections, the middle ground is often where you're going to find your answers. Thank you, gentlemen. I hope you all enjoyed this episode half as much as I did. It's an episode I've been waiting so long to record, and it not only lived up to the hype, but it absolutely exceeded it, and then some. The Roundtable, it's here to stay. In fact, you'll see another one later this month previewing the upcoming Ryder Cup. But for today, I can't thank my guests enough. Jimmy Wright, Trey Fernandez, Brett Needham, they all, as always, did a spectacular job. This was a huge endeavor to take on, especially for these three guests, and they not only did all the hard work, they made it look easy. Especially since we're not recording in a state-of-the-art studio. We're doing the best we can. This took a lot of prep on their end. To do half of what we do here at the Baker's Dozen podcast, it doesn't happen without the amazing guests that we have and the support that I receive constantly. We'll be right back in the studio next week with our second episode of the fourth season with Trey Fernandez right back in the studio, because it's time to preview the upcoming college football season, and the week following, it's Jimmy Wright with the NFL preview. Those two are perfect for each of those jobs. I couldn't ask for more. We're also less than a month away, as I said, from our next roundtable, this time focusing on the Ryder Cup, with several names regular listeners will remember well when it comes to our golf coverage here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. Whether you're a longtime listener to the show or this is your first episode, please support the show by clicking the subscribe button on iTunes or the podcast app, or you can bookmark us at our Podomatic.com page. However you choose to support us, we truly thank you. But by subscribing, look, you get every episode free immediately after it downloads. It could be dropping at midnight, in the afternoon, during the week, or on the weekend. Whether it's a special edition episode, it's a quick hit episode, it's 10-minute parking, anything. Whether it's the latest money problems where we're making picks for that weekend. Every single episode, including those posted previously in our archive, it's available to you. And if you check out our archive, you're going to realize that we talk sports, politics, pop culture. Sometimes it's specific, sometimes we mash them up.
but it's a fantastic time every time I get somebody in the studio to join me and we can talk about what matters to us. Again, my name is River City Clement, and I could not be more fortunate that you listened to today's episode. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, link up with us on social media, whether Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, for plenty of updates for what to expect from our fourth season here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. But until then, it's on to the next one.
Alright. You're right, by the way. That guy rules.
Yeah, no doubt.
Do you see what he did to his wedge? He got rest in peace Harambe stamped into his wedge.
Oh my god, I fucking love this guy.
Love him.
Was that recorded?
I hope so. I really do.
That's fucking beautiful. On his wedge, dude.
Yeah,
that's fucking perfect, dude. That is fucking perfect.
He signed a contract with Natty Light, too.
I'm jealous. I didn't think of that.